Rediscover God's Word, verse by verse, chapter by chapter. This is Real Bible Study with teacher Tom Bradford. Welcome to Torah Class.
This fourth chapter of Zechariah is aimed at encouraging Zerubbabel, the civic leader of the returned Jews from Babylon, in his role as the Persian-appointed governor of Yehud. Now, the chapter before this one did essentially the same as concerned Joshua, the religious leader of the returned Jews, in his role as the Persian-appointed high priest of the revived Hebrew faith community and as the head of the Levitical priesthood. And then what we need to gather from these two chapters is that while it was the Persian king that appointed these two Judean leaders, these two men apparently had inward doubts about whether God approved of them as legitimate. And just as clearly, the Judean people, and here I'm using the terms Jewish and Judeans, is more or less synonymous, had doubts about it as well. And indeed, that divine validation and encouragement is the focus of chapter 3 for Joshua and chapter 4 for Zerubbabel. Now, since the primary mode of communicating these several prophecies that were being given to Zechariah was symbolism, then chapter 4 uses a menorah and two olive trees as its symbol. And as we discussed last week, because this is a vision, there is no intent for the symbolic elements to accurately represent something real that has or currently is in existence. That is, the description of the menorah is nothing like what we've seen before. There is no evidence that a menorah configured in this particular way was ever built and used in the temple. Nonetheless, it is immediately understood that it is intended to call to mind the temple menorah. There is nothing to indicate that the olive trees in the vision were anything other than ordinary looking, as one would expect. Even so, in chapter 4, verse 4, Zechariah says he can't discern the meaning of this symbol. And to which the interpreting angel of the vision more or less says, why not? Implying this ought to be a no-brainer for Zechariah. But since Zechariah didn't get it, then neither should we feel as though it ought to be self-evident for us. Great Bible scholars over the centuries have had a field day trying to figure it out. So there are various interpretations of it. Now, we ended last time with the 10th verse of chapter 4. So let's reread a portion of Zechariah to lay the groundwork for today's lesson. Open your Bibles to Zechariah chapter 4. Zechariah chapter 4. And we're just going to read from verse 8 to the end of chapter 4. Zechariah chapter 4, starting at verse 8. This message from Adonai came to me. The hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this house, and his hands will also finish it. Then you will know that Adonai Tzevaot sent me to you. For even someone who doesn't think much of a day when such minor events take place will rejoice at seeing the plumb line in the hand of Zerubbabel. So these seven are the eyes of Adonai that range about over all the earth. And I replied by asking him, well, what are those two olive trees on the right and the left side of the menorah? And then I asked the question again, what are those two olive branches discharging gold-colored oil through the two gold spouts. And he replied, "Don't you know what they are?" And I answered, "No, my lord." And he said, "These are the two who have been anointed with oil. They are standing with the Lord of all the land." Now, as we go forward, be reminded that just as Joshua represents himself and also symbolically represents the office of the high priest and of all the priesthood, so Zerubbabel represents himself and also symbolically represents the office of the civic ruler of the Judean people, as well as all the Judean people themselves. So the message of verse 8 is, God is giving this part of the vision oracle directly to Zechariah. Verse 9 is a statement of Yahweh's divine validation of Zerubbabel as the God-approved leader to complete the temple rebuilding project. And that because of the way the ancients thought of temples, being associated not only to a god, but also to a king, then even though Zerubbabel was not a king, the Judeans ought to consider his function and position before God as king-like. Thus, just as the first temple was called Solomon's Temple, then this rebuilt one should be thought of as Zerubbabel's temple. Now, verse 10 must be approached with a better translation than most Bible versions supply. And I suggest it ought to be the following to get the original and true intent of it across. Does anyone scorn a day of small beginnings? When they see the stone of distinction in the hand of Zerubbabel, they shall rejoice. Those seven are the eyes of the Lord, ranging over the whole earth. Okay, that is, no one treats with contempt a day of small beginnings. No reasonable person who has the goal or hope of seeing something grand accomplished despises the day when the necessary series of small steps that will be needed to reach that goal begins. Sometimes the beginning is little more than an inauguration ceremony. In this case, it is that when building temples, kings customarily lay the first brick, so to speak. So Zerubbabel is depicted as holding a plumb bob in his hand as the ceremonial beginning of the building process. The stone of distinction more literally reads the tin stone. Now what this is talking about is this weighted object attached to the end of a string that allows a builder to align stones straight up and down, not leaning one way or the other. And this weighted object is made of tin. Calling it a stone is just a euphemistic way of saying it's heavy, like a stone, because no doubt in centuries prior to using metal, the weighted object used was a stone. Now moving to verse 11. We find that Zechariah is still perplexed over the issue of the symbolic meaning of these two olive trees in his vision. He reads, "I replied by asking him, 'What are those two olive trees on the right and left sides of the menorah?' Now recall that there is a bowl sitting above the menorah in which oil from the olives is placed. That bowl acts as a reservoir for the olive oil that is then distributed to each of the seven oil lamps via seven connecting tubes. So when trying to comprehend this symbol, we need to give as much or probably more weight to the olive itself than to the tree that produces it, because it's all about the oil that is squeezed from the olives. Now, I think my interpretation of this is validated by what comes next. Because in verse 12 we read that I ask the question again, what are those two olive branches discharging gold-colored oil through the two gold spouts? It's all about the oil. Now, as far as the interpreting angel is concerned, Zechariah has asked the same question twice. Thus, the angel responds with the same answer a second time. Don't you know what it means? To which Zechariah replies, no. Well, let's review that the golden lampstand, the menorah, represents the presence of God among his people. So what do the two branches with olives that produce the oil then symbolize? Well, here's what the angel says in verse 14. He said, those are the two who have been anointed with oil. They are standing with the Lord of all the land. Now, first, I question this complete Jewish Bible translation. Practically all other translations, including those of Jewish sources, say that these two are standing with the Lord of all the earth, not standing with the Lord of all the land. The difference is substantial. The word translated as earth or land is eretz, and indeed, it can be used either way. However, when we look at the context, we see that the word used to declare who exactly it is that is sovereign over all the eretz, the word is in Hebrew, Adon. While Lord is not the wrong translation of Adon, it ought not be capitalized because it is not meant to be used as a proper noun. That is, it's not the name, a name, or it's not an official title. Rather, it is meant to be descriptive. So I think it would be better to say, standing with the master of all the earth. Little L Lord means the same thing as master, but Lord is not in common usage in modern times to refer to someone who's in charge, someone having power or authority, so master's better. Therefore, what is being stated is that the scope of the master's sovereignty is not just the immediate land of Yehud, but rather the entire known world. Second, looking at the first part of this verse, a translation revision is also necessary. Much better and more literal in verse 14 is this. And he saith, these are the two sons of the oil who are standing by the Lord, the master of the whole earth. Sons of oil is in Hebrew, B'nai Ichar. And before we can understand this, we need to know that grammatically, Ichar is not a general term for oil produced from olives, but rather it is speaking specifically of fresh oil or new oil. And when we back away and we look at the entire context of the books of Haggai and Zechariah as they operate together, then we see that one of the major matters being dealt with is that the returned Judeans' expectations of their fields producing abundantly has been dealt a disappointing blow. The crops of every kind have been producing but a fraction of what they should have been. The reason? Lack of consistent rain. The reason for the inconsistent rain? The leaders and the people have been disobedient by putting their own wants and needs above God's command, thus dragging their feet on rebuilding the temple. So, new or fresh oil is directly associated with a bountiful harvest. In our context, it is symbolic that divine favor has returned to the land and the Judean people, because the temple rebuilding project has begun again in determined urgency. thus pleasing Yahweh. Bottom line, sons of oil is not to be taken literally. Rather, it is yet another expression. It more indicates something fruitful, abundant. Actually, in this passage, it carries a dual meaning, as so many Hebrew expressions do. One meaning concerns bounty and fertility. In this case, a newly returned bounty and fertility of the land. And the other meaning is that this concerns two persons or individuals. That is, two individuals are to be associated with the joy of God's returned presence, which has led to this increased crop yield throughout Yehud, which is the reward for rebuilding God's house, the temple. Can we identify these two individuals? Certainly. It's the two that have been the subject of chapters 3 and 4, Joshua and Zerubbabel. They are the two olive trees. Now, I want to remind you of something that I will repeat again a few times as we continue in Zechariah. Every vision, every oracle, every prophecy of Zechariah must be taken in the context of the contemporary world of those returning Jews from Babylon when Zechariah was given and then wrote down all of this prophetic information. A modern Bible student, no matter where on this planet this student might reside, is greatly challenged by this because attempting to understand these symbols that only have meaning in the context of Zerubbabel's time and circumstances, it requires much study of those ancient times. One cannot merely read the words and then somehow know what the intent is. Unfortunately, especially in the Gentile Christian world, in lieu of doing the needed research, the tendency is to correlate these biblical words and symbols to modern examples of our day. The results are interpretations that can be far off the mark. Here is yet another example of this phenomenon from one of the greatest Bible academic teams of the past three centuries. Keel and DeLeach say this about this passage. The two children of oil cannot be the Jews and Gentiles, or Israel and the Gentile world in their fruitful branches, because the candlestick is a symbol of the church. See, applied through the filter of centuries of Constantinian Christian doctrines, and through attempting to correlate ancient symbols to more modern things, rather than understanding them with their own ancient time and culture, then meaning truly becomes distorted, if not lost altogether. And as a result, a fissure is opened from the underlying foundation of anti-Semitism of the Constantinian church. And what comes bubbling up are the streams and streams of erroneous conclusions and statements as the one I just read to you. Well, let's move on to Zechariah chapter 5. Open your Bibles to Zechariah chapter 5. You'll read it all. Again, I raised my eyes, and I saw in front of me a flying scroll. And he said to me, "What do you see?" And I replied, "I see a flying scroll 30 feet long and 15 feet wide." And then he said to me, "This is the curse that goes out over the face of all the land. For according to what is written on one side, everyone who steals will be swept away, and according to what is written on the other side, everyone who swears will be swept away. I will release it, says Adonai Zebaot, and it will enter the house of the thief and the house of anyone who swears falsely by my name. It will stay there inside the house and consume it completely, even its timbers and stones." Then the angel speaking with me went forward and said to me, Now raise your eyes and see what this thing is passing by. And I asked, what is it? And he said, this is the ephah measure, a one bushel dry measure passing by. And then he added, this is their eye in all the land. And next I saw a lead disc lifted up to reveal a woman sitting in the ephah. And he said, this is evil. And he threw her down into the ephah and pressed the lead weight over its opening. While I raised my eyes, I saw two women coming with the wind in their wings, for they had wings like those of a stork. And they lifted the ephah up between the earth and the sky. And I asked the angel speaking with me, where are they taking the ephah? And he answered me, to build it a shrine in the land of Shinar. And when it's ready, the ephah will be set down there on its base. Now, the opening verse that speaks of Zechariah lifting or raising his eyes meant to do something again. It means to return to looking at a God-sent vision oracle. This time, the symbol is a flying scroll. Now, the Hebrew that is translated as scroll is Megillah. Now, technically speaking, a Megillah is a rolled up, not a rolled out, scroll. So a few Bible versions will call it a roll instead of a scroll. Now, once again, the difficult and unique symbolism we find in Zechariah confronts us. There is no other place in the Bible, nor is there any known non-Hebrew document that speaks of a flying scroll. However, because it is used symbolically and doesn't attempt to picture a real object in the real world, then the trick is to sort through exactly what that symbol represents. Now, the size of the scroll plays a large part of understanding what it means. The complete Jewish Bible doesn't help us, as it uses a measurement that's not literal. It gives it to us in feet. The literal reading about the dimensions of the scroll is that it is 20 cubits by 10 cubits. So, is this a flying billboard? The scrolls unfurled? Or is this a flying roll? The scroll is rolled up, like for storage. There are thoughts in both directions, but despite the conjectures, it seems to me that a vision of a rolled-up scroll that speaks of its rectangular dimensions of 20 by 10 cubits makes little sense. This scroll has been rolled out so that its length and width can be seen by Zechariah. Now, equally important to the dimensions of it is that it's flying in the air. Now, the whole point of this is movement. The movement of the scroll works similarly in meaning to the horses of different colors that roam the earth. The idea is universality, comprehensiveness. It indicates that the scroll's contents are not just locally effective. Rather, it applies to a large portion of the world and people, if not all. What's the scroll about? Well, any scroll contains writing. It's where covenants are recorded. Scrolls are important records that are usually placed in libraries. Back to the dimensions. Now, are these fanciful or meaningful? And, or do they actually connect to something? Some commentators think that it is the 2-to-1 ratio that we ought to pay attention to, or that the huge dimensions are just to create an effect of awe in the prophet, and then finally to the reader. I don't think so. When dimensions are stated in such a straightforward manner, then we are to take them more literally, in order to see what they might correspond to. And since verse 3 tells us this scroll is the curse that goes out and applies to lawbreakers, then we immediately get it This must be representative of the law of Moses, which is more than merely another law code. It's also a covenant between God and Israel. Zechariah 5:3. Then he said to me, "This is the curse that goes out over the face of all the land, for according to what is written on one side, everyone who steals will be swept away, and according to what's written on the other side, everyone who swears will be swept away." See, just as the overriding context of Zechariah and Haggai is the temple, then clearly what comes out of the temple is part of it. And at this time in history, the temple and its significance was less important to the largest part of Judean society than it had been before their exile. And we see this reflected by the mere 5% of the Jewish exiles who decided to come back when given the opportunity. They, of course, had read and heard stories of the temple, but had never actually seen it or experienced it, because they were either very small children when exiled to Babylon, or, for the vast bulk, they'd been born in Babylon. This also means that the law of Moses and its contents was lesser known, thus having lesser relevance to the younger generation of the exiles. And because the temple no longer existed, then the priesthood essentially no longer existed in any meaningful way. According to the Torah, the priests were only granted the temple and its grounds to do their service upon. They also had been granted a string of cities of refuge to operate, but this seems to have faded away over the centuries. Once in Babylon, then, priests served no functional purpose. Thus, the law of Moses, all that it prescribed, took a back seat in the minds of the people. In its place arose some ad hoc houses of meeting and prayer, led mostly by concerned laymen. Historically, it had never been the job of anyone other than the priests to teach the law of Moses to the people and then to enforce it. Thus, what came from these home fellowship meetings up in Babylon was a mixed bag of those laymen's understanding of the law, along with some traditions and customs they created relative to their current circumstances. Although no doubt these traditions and customs were said to express the intent of the law of Moses, it was this innovation of laymen leading and teaching the law instead of the priests that evolved into the synagogue system. Now, we are told that the original Torah had been placed in the Ark of the Covenant, but the Ark had gone missing when Babylon invaded Judah. And so it would, until this day, never again be found. I doubt it still exists, although some claim to have seen it, probably having been melted down for its precious gold. No doubt there were copies of the Torah by now that were in the possession of the priests that had gone off to Babylon. However, in viewing this reality from an overall effect on the people, the law's relevance and its commands for the exiles in Babylon were, in most cases, just kind of fading from their minds and their memories. They now lived in a society that was governed by a different set of rules and laws, operated in a different notion of morality. Therefore, when the exiles came home, in order to get their historic brand of faith operating again, the temple, as the center of their faith, had to be reinstated. If the temple was reinstated, then the priesthood had to be reinstated for the temple to operate. And in order to run the temple and the priesthood, And for Zerubbabel and Joshua to rule over the people, so did the law of Moses have to be reinstated, because temple, priesthood, and law of Moses all worked together to form the core of the covenant that made Israel uniquely Israel, their covenant relationship with God. Now, Joshua represented the temple and the priesthood. Zerubbabel represented the civil governance of the people. Now, the flying scroll symbolically represented the Torah and the law of Moses. However, for the moment, the focus is on the curses side of the law for those who break it. So, a third aspect to the symbolism of the flying scroll is that the flying represented swift movement, such that the provisions of the law would be reestablished and quickly visit the lawbreakers. Let's be clear about this curse aspect of the law, because it is so terribly misunderstood within traditional Christianity. Therefore, it is so radically misspoken about. The Hebrew word used here for curse is Allah. Doesn't mean curse in the sense of a blasphemous word or phrase, nor does it mean an expression of anger. It is a word that operates within covenant language, and it is part of the terms of a covenant. It is that part of a covenant that says what happens when a party to the covenant breaches its terms. The law of Moses covenant provides for two basic outcomes: blessings for obedience to God's commands, curses for disobedience. Curse is more properly seen as a penalty equivalent to a sentence handed down by a court of law for a violation. That is, if one obeyed the law of Moses, they could expect God's shalom and fruitfulness in their lives. But if they broke a commandment, there would be a penalty, a prescribed consequence based upon a hierarchy of the seriousness of the sin involved in what is commonly known as a lex talionis structure. That is, the punishment is proportionate to the seriousness of the crime that's committed. It is no different from most Western legal systems in existence today. No one has to worry about being punished if they obey the laws of society. Yet, just because there are punishments in these legal systems for breaking the various laws, that hardly means that the legal system itself is only about oppressing and punishing people to make them unhappy slaves to that society's laws. Constantinian Christianity, however, has twisted the meaning of curse for its own purposes, saying that the term the curse, or the curse of the law, as found in the Bible, means the law of Moses is no more nor less than a system of oppression upon people, making the law of Moses itself nothing but a needless heavy burden upon the people to appease a God who can never be fully appeased. All one has to do is to read the Torah to just dismiss such a slanderous notion. Now, upon the return of the Babylonian exiles to their former homeland after 70 years of exile, God then determined it was time for a re-recognition of the authority of the law of Moses within the Judean community. The flying scroll is a visualization of his determination to bring social cohesion and stability to the Judeans through the force of that covenant made on Mount Sinai that by now was 700 years old. if I could presume to add a tagline to the symbol of the flying scroll, it would be, the law of Moses is again in effect everywhere. Now, when in verse 2, the interpreting angel asks Zechariah what he sees, the main focus is on the flying scroll's dimensions of 20 cubits by 10 cubits. Well, now that I've filled in some background for you, it ought to come as no surprise that the porch of Solomon's temple that lay at the entrance to the holy place was 20 cubits by 10 cubits. Some of those Bible commentators who do see a connection between the dimensions of the flying scroll and the temple claim that these dimensions must represent the holy place, that front chamber of the temple sanctuary. This cannot be correct, because that is not the dimensions of the original wilderness tabernacle's front chamber, nor that of Solomon's temple. But it is the dimensions of Solomon's porch, where those two giant columns, one called Boaz, the other called Yachin, were on display. And we know this is the case, because it's recorded, 1 Kings 6:3. And the porch before the temple of the house, 20 cubits was the length thereof, according to the breadth of the house, 10 cubits was the breadth thereof before the house. Now, this association of the ulam, that's the Hebrew word for this porch, and the flying scroll then represent the reinstatement of the very place where the hall, where the law had been used for centuries to judge cases. Just as in the smaller walled Israelite cities, when cases would be brought to the elders who sat at the city gates to judge, so especially difficult cases that were brought to the priests in Jerusalem to judge were brought to the ulam, to that porch. Now, the first crime against the law of Moses that is listed in Zechariah 5:3 is stealing. And it is just what we think of it, taking something that doesn't belong to us. It's a crime of human against human. The second crime is swearing. This does not mean blasphemy. It's a legal term. It means perjury. And while we can in one way see this as an intent to harm a human, God more sees it as a crime against him, because swearing always involves invoking the name of your God. In this case, invoking Yahweh's name as the guarantor of your statement. So it is not that these two crimes are the narrow limit of what the curse is to affect. Rather, they are just representative of all the crimes of human against human and human against God. Now, the comment that these criminals will be swept away is meant to conjure up the enduring mental picture of the great flood. God puts these people in the same category as everyone but Noah and his immediate family. And those people were all destroyed by an act of divine wrath. In verse 4, this is further explained. I will release it, says Adonai Zebaot, and it will enter the house of the thief and the house of anyone who swears falsely by my name. It will stay there inside the house and consume it completely, even its timbers and stones. The complete Jewish Bible says, I will release it. The Hebrew more literally says, I will bring it forth. The complete Jewish Bible says this is going to happen. The Hebrew says this has happened. It's already happened. More, God is not allowing the curse to go out the way one would release a lion from a cage that has held this lion back from doing what lions do. He himself has intentionally sent it out to do what he intends to do. And when this speaks of the curse entering the house of the thief and the perjurer, it means that anyone who commits sins will not go unfound. Even if one feels safe and hidden inside his own home, the consequence for their covenant violation will seek them out, and it is assured they will bear the grievous results. And when we move on to the fifth verse of chapter 5, another vision is given. This time the vision symbol is of a woman inside of an ephah. Now, like the previous vision of the flying scroll, the interpreting angel is involved in gaining Zechariah's attention for him to see it. And while this apparently comes quickly after the previous action, there's no way for sure to know how much time passed. The statement of raise your eyes and see what this thing is could easily mean here is another vision. And no time at all has passed since the flying scroll vision, but we can't know for certain. However, what the flying scroll explains about what happens to sinners, the next verse, beginning with verse 5, offers another perspective on the matter. What we are to notice is that while the ephah seems to be the primary vision object, in fact, it's what's inside of it that's the point. An ephah is a means of measurement of dry goods. It doubles as the meaning of the container that the dry goods are in. So saying ephah is like saying bushel. We can easily equate bushel and bushel basket as essentially being the same things. Now, to help us visualize it, an ephah was slightly more or a bit less than the size of a bushel. No one knows for sure. What might not be so apparent is that an ephah was the largest unit of dry goods measurement of volume, not weight, in use in biblical times. When we read of the omer, as in counting the omer, meaning counting the days between the Passover and Shavuot biblical feasts, that is said to be the equivalent of 10 ephahs. But omers were simply ritual-oriented, used only in ritual language. And there was no such thing as an actual omer-sized container, nor was the omer used as a standard measure of dry goods and commerce. Everything was ephah-based. Zechariah 5:6, and I asked, what is it? And he said, this is the ephah measure passing by. And he added, this is the eye, this is their eye in all the land. The complete Jewish Bible, therefore, incorrectly interprets the sense of the meaning of ephah, as do many Bible versions. It explains that the point of it is its size. Rather, we need to analyze this symbol in the sense of ephah, more meaning a basket or a container, not as a unit of measurement. The next verse explains why that is. Now, before we go there, what is this strange wording? To end this verse, it says, this is their eye in all the land. Indeed, the Hebrew word translated to eye is ein. But can this be correct? If we keep this as literal as possible, then there is no logical connection between a basket and a human eye. Well, the Greek Septuagint, created about 250 BC as a Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, takes this word differently. It takes it to mean their iniquity. But the Latin translations read I. While I certainly don't know the answer, my suspicion is that the word I also at one time had a secondary meaning as appearance. That is, to the eye, what something looked like. But then we get to verse 7. Next I saw a lead disc lifted up to reveal a woman sitting in the ephah. What a strange sight. A lead lid covers a container, and within the container sits not grain, not some other commodity, but rather a woman. This is strong evidence that the size of the basket has no meaning, because an ephah is only about 1 cubic foot. The woman would have to be very tiny to fit in such a small space. So here, size simply plays no role in the symbol, even though size was everything in the matter of the flying scroll. There is a woman in a container with a lead lid on top of it. What has a lead lid to do with anything? Why would there be a woman inside a basket? That's what we'll explore the next time we meet.
For more teachings of real Bible study and to rediscover God's Word with Tom Bradford, visit Torah Class today on the web, streaming TV, or download the Torah Class mobile app.